Nicolas Maduro takes a drastic move. Could it be his last? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Maduro regime arrested one of the top aides for opposition leader Juan Guaido. Also, Russian planes arrived in Venezuela with troops over the weekend. We'll get the latest on Venezuela and the recent meeting between Caribbean leaders and President Trump. Also, needle exchanges are illegal in Florida, except in Miami-Dade County. That may soon change as Florida lawmakers debate taking the county's successful program statewide. Health News reporter Sammy Mack shares stories from people who use the program and how it impacted their lives. And finally, there are a lot of expensive high-rises going up in Miami, but are there enough buyers and renters for these spaces? Researcher Richard Florida explains why South Florida has become one of the most expensive places to live and how we can create more affordable housing. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Venezuela's opposition leader Juan Guaido says authoritarian President Nicolas Maduro is not far from being ousted. Guaido told Reuters over the weekend that his allies are talking to high-level military leaders about defecting to his side, and the U.S. stepped up sanctions against Maduro's socialist regime. But in reality, Maduro still looks firmly entrenched in power. Yesterday, two Russian planes reportedly landed in Venezuela with a military advisor and 100 troops. And late last week, Maduro's security agents arrested Guaido's top aide. Meanwhile, President Trump met with Caribbean leaders at Mar-a-Lago this last weekend to discuss the region's support for his campaign to dislodge Maduro from power. Joining us now is Latin American correspondent Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure.
As it is for me, Luis. Thanks.
Update on the arrest of Guaido's top chief, Roberto Marrero. What do we know about where he is at the moment?
We know that he's in the hands of what's called the SEBIN, the intelligence security agency in Venezuela. That's all we know. Late last week, they raided his home. They took him away. And it was it's a double-sided coin. It's had a very chilling effect on the opposition and Guaido's people in Venezuela, because this is the biggest attack that's come yet on them. But on the other hand, it's sort of galvanizing Guaido supporters. There was a huge rally over the weekend out in the eastern part of Venezuela as a response to this. And so it's sort of working both ways.
And, I mean, is there now a fear that Guaido, because there's always been a fear, concern that would they arrest Guaido?
Right. My hunch is that they will not, at least not in the short term. And there's a reason for that. And it has to do with Cuba. Let's keep in mind that Cubans are really running the security show in Venezuela. And if you look back in history, let's go back about 15, 16 years ago in Cuba. There was a dissident leader there named Oswaldo Payá, the late Oswaldo Payá. And he was different as a dissident because he actually took this action where he challenged the Castro regime to reform the Constitution. And they said, well, you need 10,000 signatures to do that. Well, he actually went out and got 10,000 signatures, handed them to Castro, and said, okay, let's start the Constitution reform process. Castro was so bugged out by this, but he didn't arrest Oswaldo Payá. He ended up arresting everybody around him, about 75 people, but he did not throw Payá in jail because Castro knew, Fidel Castro is the guy I'm talking about, he knew that that would cause such an international backlash that it would create too many problems for him. So I think they're using the same MO in Venezuela right now. They're going to arrest a lot of people around Guaido, but not Guaido himself.
And in hopes of just basically stopping Guaido, slowing him down, shutting him up?
As I said, having that chilling effect on his movement. So they keep Guaido out of jail and they can say, well, we didn't arrest Juan Guaido, the guy you were calling the legitimate president. But by arresting everyone around him, it keeps that thought in the air that at any moment we could arrest Juan Guaido if we wanted to.
So after the news of Marrero's arrest, the U.S. tightened sanctions on Venezuela, this time on the National Development Bank. What can you tell us about this move? What does it mean to Maduro?
Not much. We have really spent the most powerful bullets we have in our chamber when it comes to sanctions. And the most significant being a few weeks ago, you'll remember, when we essentially cut off oil imports from Venezuela because we fixed it so that the revenues from that oil would not go to the Maduro regime. It would go to an escrow account that goes to Guaido and his, quote, presidency when and if he becomes president. So that was our strongest sanction. What all the sanctions that come after this now, like the one on the development bank that you just mentioned, they could cause some discomfort, but this is all minor now compared to the big bullet that we shot out of the gun a few weeks ago.
So everything that's happening right now in Venezuela, the instability and everything else, how is that impacting it? We know, for example, with so many of the refugees, how it's impacting Colombia, but how about other countries around Venezuela? How is it impacting them?
Well, Brazil also is being impacted quite a bit by this, and Brazil is probably the country that's leading the charge under their new president, Jair Bolsonaro, leading the charge to put more international pressure on Maduro to get out of power. But really, things are in sort of a limbo right now. What we're doing really more than anything else is waiting for that one big sanction that I just talked about, the oil sanctions. We're waiting now for that to work. And it could very well begin to start showing its effects on the Maduro regime. Last week, for example, or this month, was the first time ever that we've essentially seen no oil, no Venezuelan oil being imported into the United States. That's a huge thing. So I think at this point, the United States and the opposition in Venezuela and the rest of the world just has to sort of sit back and wait to see if this really does start to undermine not just the financial, but the political health of the Maduro regime.
And just, you know, as we reported, as we found that Russia now sent two planes into Venezuela with a military advisor and 100 troops?
Well, the 100 troops are there just to sort of bolster the Maduro regime's security agents, I think. They're sort of providing some they're sort of military bouncers. They're sort of providing extra security for Maduro and his top officials, I think. Although the Russian government says, no, they're protecting their investments in Venezuela. But this is not new. We actually saw this happen about a month or so ago, I think at the beginning in February. So Russia is trying to show the United States that Venezuela has a strong friend standing up for it.
I was just wondering, what is Putin's take on Venezuela? Is it their investments, or are they really siding with Maduro?
It's both financial investments and political investments. Putin has a very strong interest in seeing regimes like Maduro's thrive in Latin America because they oppose the United States. Putin has been very transparent about the fact that he wants to undermine democracy in this hemisphere. And so he has been supporting regimes like Maduro's, like Nicaragua's, like Bolivia's, as a way of undercutting United States influence. And these two planes that went in yesterday into Venezuela are a perfect example of this.
We're talking with WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett about the latest news coming out of Venezuela. And some of the other news, too, was, as you spoke on the South Florida Roundup on Friday, President Trump in Mar-a-Lago on Friday with some of the leaders of Caribbean nations, five Caribbean nations, again, continuing to press this idea that the U.S. is ready for action against Maduro's regime. But what do you make of, the visit by the Caribbean leaders? They're looking for some U.S. support. Obviously, they're on our side when it comes to the issues of dealing with Maduro.
Well, these five countries, you have to go take a look back, though. In the past year or so, as the United States has tried to muster hemispheric support in its crusade against Maduro, the Caribbean has always been an obstacle because most of the countries in that region have been receiving tons of low-cost oil from Venezuela, and they don't want to tick off Maduro then by sort of siding with the United States in its pressure to get rid of him. However, because of the epic economic catastrophe in Venezuela, Venezuela's had to pull back on all that oil it sends to the Caribbean countries. And now we're starting to see some cracks in that neutral facade that the Caribbean has been trying to put up. So you're seeing some countries like the five that met with Trump on Friday at Mar-a-Lago coming over to the United States side when it comes to either not recognizing Maduro as the legitimate president anymore of Venezuela or recognizing Juan Guaido as the legitimate president of Venezuela, as the U.S. does.
And so Trump basically is dangling, you know what, investments. Stay on our side and there's some investments in it for you.
But so far it's just dangling. He did say at the meeting that he would send the Overseas Private Investment Corporation representatives. That's an agency of the U.S. government that helps with development investments in poorer countries like the Caribbean. We'll send visitors there to see what you need. Now, whether or not that's actually going to translate into the kind of substantive aid that these Caribbean countries need in order to replace all of that wonderful subsidized oil that they were getting from Venezuela, that remains to be seen.
Well, now the U.S. is really one of the top producers of oil and gas. I mean, do we then have the opportunity to jump in and say we could be that provider?
One would think. I mean, at its height, this program, which was known as Petrocaribe, that Venezuela was using to deliver all this oil to the Caribbean, it was sending about 200,000 barrels of oil a day to these Caribbean countries. And I think these Caribbean countries now, they're saying, look, the United States, we're coming over to your side on this. Can you offer us the same thing? So that there's sort of a high bar for the United States to meet in terms of satisfying these Caribbean countries' needs.
Let's come back to Juan Guaido and what he had said to Reuters recently. And he had said that the Maduro regime is in the final stages. There are a lot of people waiting for this to happen. But what do you make of that? That, you know, Guaido's comments that it's the final stages.
That's very optimistic. As you and I have discussed before, getting rid of dictators anywhere in the world, it takes time. And as I said before, we have shot our biggest arrow from our quiver in terms of sanctions, economic sanctions against Venezuela. Now we've got to wait and see if they're going to work. And in the meantime, it could take a long time for them to work in the sense of toppling this regime because he still has the military command in Venezuela on his side.
And now Guaido is saying that he's now talking to some top Venezuelan military leaders?
He's been saying that for a while.
Is there any news of defections?
Not any significant yet. What you're seeing in terms of defections is hundreds of, and I think it's more than 1,000 now, of sort of lower level rank and file Venezuelan military defecting over to, say, Colombia, you know, sneaking across the border to get out of the situation. But in terms of the guys who make the decisions, we're really not seeing any sort of significant defections on that level. And until that happens, Maduro is going to be sitting there rather safely until the money runs out. And that's where these sanctions come in. And that's what we're going to have to wait and see if it really happens.
So we're waiting for the sanctions. Russian planes are landing in Venezuela, and we don't know what else is going on beyond that. Tim Padgett, again, WLRN's America's correspondent, again, giving us the updates in Venezuela. Thanks so much, Tim. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right. You can hear more about this, by the way, during the LATAM report coming out tomorrow. You can also find it at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Miami-Dade County's needle exchange program could soon reach all parts of Florida. We'll have more on that coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and not to let Joshua Johnson take all the glory, starting April 1st, you can also hear Sundial twice a day, because we'll be replaying at 8 o'clock. Just wanted to mention that. All right, now moving on to our next segment. Florida continues to have some of the highest new HIV rates in the country, and Miami continually lists as the city with the highest rates of new HIV diagnosis. It's a battle that's been we've been fighting since the 80s. Now, at the height of a nationwide opioid epidemic, the spread of infections like HIV and hepatitis C are a very big concern. One program seeking to combat the spread of HIV is the trial project Idea Exchange here in Miami-Dade County. This is the only legal needle exchange program in the state. And there's currently a legislative proposal in Tallahassee that would allow a similar program in other cities around Florida. WLRN health news reporter Sammy Mack joins us now to share some of the reporting on this story. Sammy, always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. First of all, remind us of what the IDEA Exchange is, how it started.
So this is a needle exchange program. And what that means is this is run by a group of public health folks who, after a lot of legislative back and forth, got permission in 2016 to set up a needle exchange, which essentially allows people who are injection drug users, so these are people who are using heroin mostly, to come in and exchange their used needles for clean ones. And the idea is it takes dirty needles out of circulation, and it's aimed at reducing the transmission of viruses like HIV and hepatitis C. And so this is a kind of public health known as harm reduction. So while these people are in the grips of addiction, the idea is you are also helping protect them from these other viruses. And while they're there, they have an opportunity to get tested for these viruses. There are people on hand who are ready to help them get into addiction treatment and to get medical care. There are a lot of other medical issues that can crop up if you're somebody who uses injection drugs. So it's the idea is come for the clean needle, stay for the wraparound services.
Where are they getting the resources? Where is that coming from?
So this receives no state funding, and it is grant run at the moment. Miami-Dade County, again, has the only legal needle exchange, and they get their grants from the drug maker Gilead, from the MacAIDS Foundation, from individuals, some of whom have family members who have experienced addiction. So right now it's kind of run through private funding. It's also supported by the University of Miami. A lot of the people who work there also work in local hospitals.
How do we know it's successful? I mean, are they tracking to see what's the data that says this is working?
Yeah, it's really interesting. They collect a lot of statistics that they report to the health department. So they're overseen by the health department. And one of the kind of splashiest numbers is that they've taken 250,000 used needles out of circulation, which is a lot of dirty needles that are not out there on the streets, that are not being disposed of improperly. So that's kind of the big one. But they also have found some other interesting data as they've been doing this work. They hand out Narcan, which is that drug that reverses opioid overdoses. They've given out a couple thousand boxes of Narcan, and based on their reporting to the state, it looks like that Narcan has been used more than 1,000 times. So that's more than 1,000 overdoses that have been prevented. So that's an interesting way of looking at it. And then, you know, there's also like all the data that they collect on who's testing positive for HIV and Hep C, people who are coming regularly to get that.
Just to understand, this program is not necessarily about trying to get people off drugs. It's about trying to stop the spread of HIV and other diseases.
I think the people who run it would say it's both. But the primary focus starts with the prevention of the HIV and the Hep C. I think that the medical professionals who work there see that as part of a larger effort to get people who are hard to reach into care for their addiction and for, you know, if they are testing positive for these viruses, for the viruses. Part of what makes this, what makes reaching some of these populations difficult is that, you know, if you are someone who is an injection drug user, there's a lot of stigma around admitting to that. And it may be difficult to ask your you know, primary care for help or find help in other ways. And this is a place where they've sort of built a reputation for themselves as being a place where you can talk openly about your struggles with addiction. And so while, again, you know, the IDEA stands for Infectious Disease Elimination Act, the sort of primary reason to be is the prevention of disease. They see also getting people into addiction treatment as part of that on a longer timeline. But that's harder. That's a lot harder.
Yeah. Hasn't always the pushback been that, well, we're just giving free needles. We're just going to, you know, we're going to spread the problem. And more people are going to want to do it.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I've been to some public meetings with the folks involved in this program and some of the people who push back. And one of the common sort of themes of the people who are pushing back against it is just that, you know, doesn't this cause more addiction doesn't make it easier. All of the research points to no. And when I say all of the research, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention actually recommends needle exchanges as part of a comprehensive plan to reduce the spread of HIV and hep C and bloodborne illnesses. And this is like going back to the 90s. I found this really interesting report to Congress from like 1995 that looked at everything that the country knew about needle exchanges to that point. And this is, you know, this is like 25 years ago. And all of the evidence pointed to, in fact, it does not encourage needle use. And that's part of the data that this particular exchange has tracked. And when they survey people who participate, not a single one of them so far has been a first-time user visiting the needle exchange. There are people who are already in it who are coming for the clean needles.
So what's interesting is, I mean, look, as you just said, so there's data going back a long time, mm-hmm. and there are needle exchange programs in other parts of the country.
Yeah.
We're so unique as a state that it only exists in Miami-Dade County right now. It's just here in this county.
Yeah.
How did we pull that off? How do we convince people, let's try it here?
Well, it took, Dr. Hansel Tooks is the guy who runs this. And he is a guy from Miami. He grew up here and he went away for college and then came back for med school. And when he was in college, he had seen needle exchanges working in other places and had seen that piece of the action of public health and was shocked when he got here and it wasn't here. So as a med student, he was trying to convince Tallahassee to pass this, and it took him four tries. And on the fourth try in 2016, the state did allow for what's known as a demonstration project. So it's kind of like the state saying, all right, you guys can try this out. Show us proof of concept, and if it works, like maybe we'll reconsider it. So now that they've got some data in hand, they're going back to Tallahassee to try and push for this bill that would allow other counties to authorize these needle exchanges. It wouldn't create needle exchanges, and it wouldn't necessarily mean that every county would have legal needle exchanges, but it would allow for a legal process by which the counties themselves could authorize it.
And they could just look and see what we've been doing here as, you know, as infrastructure for how to do that. Talking again with WLRN Health News reporter Sammy Mack. She's been covering the Miami-Dade trial project, IDEA, IDEA exchange, the only legal exchange program in the state. Now, there is legislation in Tallahassee proposing allowing, as she just mentioned, similar, at least, the, you know, again, that structure for other cities and counties around the state to try it as well. You've met some people who've been going to these mobile van exchange units, and one of the members of the IDEA exchange program goes by Arrow. Tell us a little bit about his journey and how the program has helped him.
Yeah. So when I first started reporting on the IDEA exchange a year ago, I went out with them to one of their mobile sites. So part of what they do is they map out where overdose information comes from, where HIV information comes from, where drug arrest information comes from, and they target hotspots, and that's where they drive. They have this little mobile van that that they can take out to sites. And so I went out to one of the sites to kind of see what it looked like. And one of the guys I met was this guy, Arrow, who at the time had been using heroin since the 70s. He was homeless. He was sleeping out under an overpass in Overtown. And he was he was not in great shape.
And we have a cut, by the way. Here's a cut. Again,
yeah, some
here's
of the, what happened.
Here's some of the reporting you've done. This is fantastic.
Actually, it doesn't encourage use. It just helps you so that you don't get any sicker than we actually are. And the needle exchange, they promote for people to stop using drugs. They're the reason why I've stopped using. They helped me get into crisis. They helped me get into the shelter across the street. And they also helped me get into the village.
How many people like him did you run into that said the same thing?
A lot. A lot. And not everybody gets to this point, right? So not everybody who uses the exchange will end up in rehab. Not everybody will end up, you know, first of all, not everybody who uses it is homeless either. There are people from all walks of life who come and from outside the county who come in because they can't get it anywhere else. But Arrow is sort of the best case scenario in a lot of ways, not always. At the time when I first met him a year ago, he was HIV negative. He did become HIV positive. Which he knew because he was getting tested every couple months through the exchange. What is a sort of kind of sideways win for him and for the exchange is that because he was being tested regularly, they caught his new infection very quickly after it happened, and he was able to get on HIV medication, and now his viral load is suppressed. So now that means it's under control enough that he can't spread the virus to anybody else. So that's another way that they're sort of positioning themselves to try and prevent the spread of the infection, is even if you have someone who is positive, getting them the medication that they need so that they can't, you know, make someone else positive.
You know, he mentioned in the cut is they also helped me get into the village. What's he talking about?
This is one of the facilities that has been working with the exchange to get people who are homeless into transitional housing and also into there are like rehab services and stuff like that. So he was off the street when I spoke to him recently. And in fact, I just heard today that he got a job. So, you know, these are the sorts of wraparound services. Again, not everybody who uses a needle exchange, if this bill passes, is necessarily going to have this level of success. But for Arrow, it's been a really, really positive impact on his life.
That is some interesting news. Tell us a little bit about the legislation being proposed right now. It's Senate Bill 366. There's been an attempt to get this passed before, but how would this work? Because you said it's not like everybody would just start one. Not every county or city would start one. How would it work?
Right. So all of this is being driven through the counties. And part of the reason for that, and this is pretty technical, is counties have sovereign immunity, which is basically a status that makes it much harder to sue them. They have lower liability. And so it allows for the operation of something like this in a way that carries less risk on their part. So the counties would have to authorize it. If someone were to propose running one of these exchanges, it would have to be, you know, a very specific kind of person running or kind of organization running it, like a hospital system, the backing of the university like we have here, a specific organization focused at like people living with AIDS. So there's rules in the legislature about who could run this thing. You or I couldn't just stand up and start one. And also it would require a lot of reporting, like what the program here in Miami does, to the health department and to other agencies. And so sort of baked into it is, some oversight and professionalism that has to be brought to it. So that's kind of part of it. It also bars any use of state funding. So
do we get a sense of what's happening in Tallahassee right now? I mean, does it have a chance?
It does. So far, it has passed its committees. It's having another committee hearing tomorrow in the Senate, and then later this week in the House. And you know, it's you can never guarantee that anything is going to happen in the legislature.
But does it have an? It's got enough support from legislators from here, at least,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is sponsored locally, and it has a lot of support here. It has a lot of support from the medical organizations in the state. So you know, over the years, kind of as they've seen how this program works, more and more organizations are backing it, which is also interesting because if you look at some of the CDC studies. Over time, in places that have needle exchanges, people are more likely to support it. And there's like this correlation between how long a needle exchange program has existed and the public support for it, which that feels very similar to what we are seeing here.
Again, talking with WLRN Health News reporter Sammy Mack about the possibility that Miami's needle exchange program could become a more statewide program. We'll learn more by checking out her story and other reporting at WLRN.org. Now, Sammy has also been covering the mental health burden of kids who survive shootings. After two young survivors from last year's shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School died by apparent suicide within the last week, the Parkland community is stressing the need for more mental health awareness and resources. Sammy, anyone who's feeling pain from tragedies like this, they can find help, but where?
So if you need help, they're 24 hours. The 211 numbers in all the South Florida counties have resources available for people who are in mental health crises. That is a resource that anybody can call. You do not have to be a survivor of the shooting at Stoneman Douglas. That is for anybody who is hurting. You can call 211 and get connected to services and counseling. There's also 24-hour telephone counseling and emotional support available through the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 1-800-273-8255. I'm going to say it one more time just in case there's anybody listening who needs it or knows somebody who might need it. 1-800-273-8255. We also have put together a list of resources that includes both hotlines and in-person mental health and crisis counseling at our website, WLRN.org.
You know, it's always a conversation that you have in newsrooms. We were having it today. I've had it in a lot of newsrooms I've worked in, is how do you cover this issue? And it's when you talk about this particular issue, you got to be very careful. There are certain guidelines. And so, I mean, really, you know, just to help people understand when news media covers it, really how we should be covering it.
Yeah. there is a phenomenon called suicide contagion. And depending on how media covers stories around suicide, and that includes news media, but it also includes, for example, Netflix's 13 Reasons Why series, if it is not done based on the best practices that have been studied in health communications, you are at risk of triggering someone to hurt themselves. And we really, really want to avoid that. This is a public health issue, and it's not helpful to sensationalize what happened or to dwell on the details and the mechanics of it. And we know from a lot of rigorous academic studies that we in the media are also in a position where we can be helpful, which is why WLRN will continue focusing on the resources that are available. You know, if there's any policy movement and the bigger picture on the impact of trauma in the community, those are the stories that we're going to focus on. And, you know, if you're interested in learning more about how we think about our responsibility here, there's a website, reportingonsuicide.org, that has a lot of the best practices and also has, you know, some of the kind of science behind how we're thinking about our responsibility and the ethical imperative to make sure that we're not covering anything in a way that would trigger someone to harm themselves.
She is WLRN health reporter Sammy Mack. We're going to continue to follow this story. And again, if you need support, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. It's available 24 hours. And again, you can find more resources at WLRN.org. Sammy, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come, how can South Florida fix its affordable housing issue? Researcher Richard Florida has a few ideas. We'll hear about those coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, we all know how expensive it is to live in South Florida, whether you're renting an apartment or you own a home. But a new report from the Miami Urban Future Initiative illustrates just how severe this problem is. A report entitled Miami Affordable Housing Crisis finds that Greater Miami, which includes Palm Beach, Broward, and Miami-Dade, is the seventh most expensive metro area to live in the U.S. 60% of folks living here spend more than a third of their income on their rent or on their mortgage. Richard Florida co-authored the report. He's a researcher that's been studying the urban problems facing the region now for more than a decade. And he sat down with Sundial producer Chris Remington for a conversation about the extent of the problem and maybe some solutions.
So, Richard, we all know how expensive it is to live here in South Florida. What surprised me in this report was comparing Miami to New York to LA to these other major cities. We rank up towards the top in terms of inaffordability. As someone that is steeped in this issue, did that data surprise you at all? Did those findings surprise you?
The problem is, you know, we're really a tale of two cities or two regions where we have incredible wealth packed along our coastlines in parts of downtown, like Miami's downtown, and in and around, you know, knowledge institutions, universities, all throughout the region. And then we just have people who are working in, you know, low-wage service jobs, not making enough to make ends meet. And that's the problem with affordability. Even though our housing prices on balance are lower than the superstar cities like New York and L.A. or San Francisco, our median incomes are also way lower. So then we get a real big crisis of affordability. I guess, Chris, I guess what I mean to say is maybe it did surprise me. Even to me, who knew Miami was unaffordable, the degree to which we are truly unaffordable.
So I want to get into some of the historical context behind it. The region was hit hard by the Great Recession and the housing bubble back in 2008. Why was South Florida particularly vulnerable during the housing crisis?
You know, we started coming here a little over a decade ago, and we rented for a few years because we wanted to test. You know, I say this to anyone, we wanted to test drive it. And I remember when the housing crisis hit, we were still renting. And actually got very good deals on rent, and then decided, you know, when the things started to recover, to buy. But the reason we were so hard hit is, you know, we were playing games, funny games down here. You know, I think probably everyone remembers that 60 Minutes segment. I watched it. I didn't live here then, and the woman was like, you know, she worked in a manicure salon, and she had bought like four houses on shady loans. And of course, we have a lot of money laundering going on in this region. So we had a lot of shady things going on, which is not unusual, right? We know and love Miami, not unusual. So that's what happened, of course. People couldn't afford to buy those homes. They had loans that were subprime. We had a lot of shady things going on. And it really just collapsed like a house of cards. I think what was also surprising, though, is the fact, the degree to which we've rebounded.
No, I wanted to get into that recovery because I saw in the report it's really interesting. From 2014 to 2018, you saw a 50% jump in housing value. And I'm just kind of curious if we have a sense as to what some of the causes are, why we had such a strong rebound in that period of time.
I don't know for sure,
yeah.
But I can speculate. I think that one thing that's happened is I'm a baby boomer. And I think, you know, people like me get tired of living in cold now. I'm kind of a snowbird. I have to go north to work, and I have a university teaching position. But many people who are my age are now nearing retirement, so they're like, the hell with that cold weather. And the statistics I've seen from New York are very interesting. There has been a long-run secular move of relatively high-end, middle-class or high-net-worth New Yorkers, particularly to southern Florida. But what we've seen is since the tax changes, that has really bumped up again. The tax changes, not only are taxes higher in the state of New York and in New York City, but the tax changes that now disallow you to deduct your state and local taxes. And I think that's in part what's happening, that people from the United States, colder parts of the United States, principally New York, but also Boston. So I think that's what's happening. Foreign buyers to some degree, but I think that's really cooled off. I think it really is Americans driving this.
And so we see this major bump in housing values, but at the same time, wages aren't following in that same path. What are some of the issues in terms of the job market down here that wages aren't following?
Well, that's why we have the affordability crisis. So, you know, what we're seeing in real time is people who derive their income elsewhere, either who are retired and have savings or a home that they could trade, or people who can commute. I mean, this trend of super commuting, it really is becoming bigger. And lots of folks who are moving here from New York, they still commute to work. Dad still commutes to work in New York. I think that's driving it. And then, of course, our job base here is not great. It's getting better. We're building a tech hub. There's no doubt. We're attracting more corporate headquarters and business that want to serve, not only from Latin America, want to serve the Latin and South American market. But, you know, the preponderance of our economy, which was our previous report, in fact, on the inequality and the wage gap from our Miami Urban Future Initiative, that those jobs are in low-wage, low-skill service jobs in hospitality, tourism, retail, and the related. And there only one other metropolitan economy in the United States is more service-intensive than us, Las Vegas. So because those jobs pay very low, our folks don't have a lot of money, and therein, as housing prices rise, we get this real squeeze.
We see high-rises getting built all over South Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm. You see high-rises right next to the studio here. But as you say in the report, there's already a surplus of expensive condos and apartments. So who are the developers targeting these towards? Who are they hoping are going to buy and rent these?
So there's this myth that there's more rich people who are somehow going to move here. I forget what the number is. It's in the report. But we have like multiple years of supply of high-end condos. And we don't have virtually any supply of the kind of affordable housing people need. And what's so striking in the report I believe that we have, of any large metro over a million people, there are 53 such metros in the country, we have the largest percenters of renters that are burdened, that are finding the cost burden, which means they're spending over 35%.
Yeah, I'm looking at the report. It's Grand Rapids is right below us, so highest in the country.
So that's what's terrifying to me, that because our incomes are low and because people don't have the money for a down payment, they have to go in the rental market. And then our rental market is such that people are paying extraordinarily high prices relative to income. And I think that's the nature of our housing. That's the real issue in our housing affordability problem. One other thing I may mention, this is not related to the report, but there's a famous sociologist at Princeton called Matt Desmond. Matt wrote a book called Evicted that won a Pulitzer Prize. And he just wrote a new report, a new study in an academic journal. That report was really terrifying. Applied to Miami. This report was for the whole country, but when you apply it to Miami, what he found is that poor people across the United States pay proportionally more, appreciably more for rent. So that if you're poor in the United States and you're a renter, you spend more of your income than anyone else because you're poor. Moreover, what he found, which was truly terrifying, is that guess what? Landlords make a heck of a lot of money off poor people because landlords don't improve the properties. They let them run down. They bought them at a low rate. Mm. And what he found that was so daunting and so scary applied to Miami, but it could apply to other cities, but applied to Miami, is that low-income people in the United States are paying the highest share of their income for rent, and landlords are making a whole boatload of money off those folks.
I'm speaking with researcher Richard Florida with the Creative Class Group. He co-authored the new report called Miami's Housing Affordability Crisis. It shows that South Florida is among the most expensive areas to live in the country. So another part of the report I wanted to dive into, the aspect that minority communities are hit the hardest by high housing costs, both for renters and for homeowners. Reports as Black and Hispanic homeowners face the steepest cost burdens. So when we look at that data, do we have a sense of how our region compares to other major metropolitan areas when we look at minority communities?
As you said, particularly African Americans here, Latino, Hispanic folks too, but obviously because so many of those Latino and Hispanic folks are recent immigrants who will not have, because of the recentness of their immigration, high incomes. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't compare well. I mean, we don't compare well on any of these measures. We always, you know, no matter what we look at, whether it's incomes, wages, housing, rent burdens, we're a tale of two cities or a tale of two regions. A small group of ultra-wealthy folks who have a lot of money and a lot of capital and a lot of wealth and can invest. And then a much larger group, not only of service workers, but disproportionately minority, more concentrated among African Americans, but also Hispanic, Latino people struggling at the bottom. And in that sense, yeah, I mean we're a reflection of America, but we tend to be in some of the toughest shape because our housing prices are relatively high and our incomes are terribly low.
But I think the Hispanic Latino population here is specifically interesting because a large portion of that population is part of that high earning class.
Yes.
So I'm curious how you kind of look at the nuance of that data when you think about our region.
One of, I think, the most impressive statistics for the Miami region, again, the metropolitan area, is that when you look at the proportion of either highly educated people, that would be people who have a college degree and more, or graduating college, or have an advanced degree or a master's degree or PhD, or if you look at the percentage of people who are members of what I call the creative class, that's scientists, technologists, business people, knowledge workers, arts and cultural people who make high incomes. Like these people make like 100 grand a year. Only one metropolitan area in the entire United States, the Silicon Valley in the Bay Area of California, has a higher percentage of those folks who are foreign born. So our immigrants are fueling our talent base. They are 40% of our highly educated people and similarly 40% of our knowledge working creative class. So that's a big deal. And, you know, those folks are folks really becoming part of the American dream. So we do very much have an escalator here. You know, Miami still is one of the places that you can get on an escalator. The problem has been that we have this mismatch in housing.
Let's try and get into some possible solutions, some ideas. There's a push for more affordable places for people to live in South Florida. Some folks are advocating for rent stabilization, but you have economists that argue rental controls can actually make things worse. So I guess I'm wondering from you, do we see solutions on the supply side, the landlords, the developers, or more on the demand side, increasing people's ability to pay their rents?
Well, we're going to need to work on both sides here. And that's why I wanted to add this report to that conversation, because in contrast to many other cities like New York or San Francisco or Boston or Chicago that have longer histories, we tend not to have these conversations here for some reason. It's harder, except with you and the newspaper, but this is not something that's on people's mind. So the first thing that's going to happen in an environment where it's a country we've decided that we don't want a federal government, rightly or wrongly, what's happening in cities around the country and is starting to happen here is people point at Amazon and say, okay, you want to build your headquarters? You got to make more affordable housing and give us better wages. Or, in Miami's case, they start to point at the real estate community. They look at those beautiful big condo towers and people making a killing. This is what's happening in New York City. And they're saying to the developers, you've got to pay. If you want to have more density or more height, you want to build a taller tower, you're going to have to devote 20 or 25% of the units in that building for affordable housing. And that's happening all across New York City. Look, rent control will be a reality. For a politician who's confronted with this, constituents who are angry, what's the easiest lever to pull? Rent control. Let's stabilize the rent. Now, we know, economists have shown, that that's probably the worst policy you could implement, because what it does is cause the landlord to say, the heck with this, I'm not going to put a penny in it. Let it run down to the dirt. What's the better policy is to have a government-private sector effort to do two things and use the right words. One, to make sure we're building not just more housing, but we're building affordable housing. So maybe it's a split. We're going to build 20 or 25% of the new units are going to be dedicated affordable. And that can work. Economists think housing vouchers can work. They're very effective. Also, the idea of a universal basic income, which is becoming much more part of the conversation and will be much more part of the conversation.
The thing I was wondering, though, is there a potential for this to be solved through the free market? As you see a lot of these expensive housing going unfilled, could developers start to see value in building more affordable housing units and stuff folks can actually buy?
Well, I think it happened in a way with the crisis, you know. One of the things we know is that the liveliness we see in downtown Miami, now it's not throughout the region, was the fact that we built a lot of condos in downtown Miami and Brickell. They couldn't be sold, so they started to rent them to young people. And, you know, when you go down there now and you see the energy in that community and you still see lots of young people, especially young people moving here from other places because we're not as expensive as New York or LA or San Francisco, they're renting apartments in that area. Yeah, we can do more. We can build studios. We can carve up units. We can begin to see older homes and make a push to renovate them and make them affordable, you know. But, you know, in California now, we're seeing a whole raft of tech startups. I talked to reporters at the San Francisco Chronicle about this that are basically home sharing. So basically what they're doing is a company is buying up these older homes and basically having a family room and a group home. Now, most of those people tend to be the younger millennial type, but you could imagine something like that occurring. But look, I think in America, we've got to recalibrate. This whole idea of the old 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square foot McMansion in the suburbs no longer has appeal. People want to live closer to where they work. They want to have more time to spend with their family. We're realizing we don't need as much space. So we've got to create, you know, workforce housing. You know, we need to build housing for our workforce that can't afford to live here, our teachers, our emergency personnel, our firefighters, our police, our service personnel. You know, that's something, because our economy is so dependent on that. That's something that could pick up steam here.
I've been speaking with researcher Richard Florida with the Creative Class Group. He's behind the new report called Miami's Housing Affordability Crisis. Mr. Florida, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much. It's always a pleasure being with you.
And Richard Florida was speaking with our Sundial producer, Chris Remington. By the way, that report entitled Miami's Affordable Housing Crisis is available on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to be discussing the Sundial Book Club title, Their Eyes Were Watching God, and we've been collecting responses from our Sundial Book Club listeners this month about how they're liking the book thus far. And we've heard from a number of you, including Susan Lee from Boynton Beach.
The author writes about these characters that just seem so absolutely authentic. Janie, the way she acts with her grandmother, the men in her life, Phoebe. And then the author emphasizes this idea that words come from thoughts, which come from this deep well of feelings. And all that is lived out or reconstructed through each person.
We also heard from Samantha Banyal, an English teacher at Mast Academy, who's been teaching the book to a number of her students.
It's been really wonderful to see how these students look at the way that Hurston uses the natural environments of Florida to help you understand what these characters are going through. Of course, there's the hurricane, and the students really latch on to that, and they feel sort of this personal connection to those descriptions of the hurricane, because so many of them have gone through that build up to the hurricane, the quiet before it actually starts. So as Florida citizens and as students who have this interest in the environment, they're continually going back to that. And I've learned a lot from their desire to really close read.
Remember, you can always join the Sundial Book Club on Facebook. Just go to Facebook and search Sundial Book Club. It's free for everybody. That's the show for this Monday, March 25th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.